Support for NPR podcasts comes from Visa, offering the Visa Signature Card, featuring concierge services for travel, dining, and entertainment at visasignature.com.
Margot got out of bed and poured her husband Albert a bowl of bran flakes. She could hear him in the other room, frantically stuffing underwear and legal documents into his duffel bag. It was already 5:15. Margot doubted he would make his 6 a.m. flight. He wasn't even dressed yet. She went to the refrigerator and took out the milk. Albert put on the phone headset and called the taxi service. Margot cringed when she heard how much he offered to pay for an airport express. She doused the cereal with milk and sat down in one of the kitchen chairs. But Albert didn't come into the kitchen. He just blew her a kiss on his way out. He didn't even close the door behind him. 3 days later, Margot returned home from Albert's funeral, sat down at the kitchen table, and began to spoon the soggy bran flakes and spoiled milk into her mouth. But it wouldn't stay down. She sank to her knees and vomited it all over the kitchen floor. If she would have insisted that Albert eat the cereal before leaving for the airport, then he would have missed his flight. And then he wouldn't have been on a plane with a terrorist bomb on it. And then she wouldn't be so utterly and completely alone. She prostrated herself on the floor, but she couldn't bring herself to pray. For Margot was done with prayer. Prayer never brought back anyone. Not her mother, not her father, not even her little Annie. So from now on, it was going to be nothing but self-immolation. From now on, she would wear hair shirts. She would eat dog food. She would sleep on a bed of nails. She would whip herself whenever possible. She would show God how worthy of his forgiveness she was. Margot stuck out her tongue into the mess of tears and vomit. But the smell was too much, and she started retching again. Perhaps President Huntington was right after all. He preached that God is never moved by the self-immolation of good Christians. According to President Huntington, it is only the blood of the infidel which is pleasing unto the Lord. The infidel. Margot jumped to her feet. She had completely forgotten. At 3 o'clock, they were going to be delivering her terrorist. Somehow, she had completely put it out of her mind. She checked the clock over the stove. It was already 1:15. Margot took out a mop from the closet and washed the floor. Then she did the dishes. Then she drew herself a bath. But just as she climbed into the water, the doorbell rang. She looked at the clock over the sink. It was now 2 p.m. She flicked on the intercom. "Who is it?" she asked. "It's Freddy," a husky female voice answered. "Just a minute," Margot replied. "I have to put some clothes on." Margot got out of the tub and dried herself off. She wrapped herself in a bathrobe and put on her slippers. As soon as she unlocked the door, Freddy thrust a poorly wrapped package into her hands. "I got you a present," she said. Freddy was wearing a silver spandex jumpsuit that somehow straightened out her massive curves. She looked like a gigantic walking refrigerator. "Thank you," Margot said softly. "Sorry I didn't make it to the funeral," Freddy said. "I missed the free shuttle out to the cemetery. And besides, I needed the time to get you your present." Margot realized she hadn't even noticed Freddy's absence at the funeral. But for certain, her other co-workers did. She wondered if Paul or Norma would say anything. Not that anyone would be surprised. Using a funeral as a pretext for taking off work to go shopping was a quintessential Freddy thing to do. It almost made Margot want to laugh. It was a whole new level of awfulness for Freddy. "Well, what are you waiting for?" Freddy said. "Open it." Margot unwrapped the purple tissue paper. It was a deluxe Walmart torture kit. Margot bit her lip. It was not a present. "Have you got him yet?" Freddy grunted. She stood on her toes and peered into the house over Margot's shoulder. "No," Margot said. "They're bringing him by later this afternoon." You are so lucky, Freddy said. I mean, not about your husband and all, but, you know, it used to be that when you got killed by terrorists, all your friends and relatives would get an infidel clone to torture and kill. It's not fair. Margot nodded her head. But that was before the Great Recession. It's not fair, Freddy repeated. Then she launched into a speech about how even though she had never known Albert, it was still as if she had lost a family member, being that she had worked with Margot at the government accounting office for so long. To keep from screaming, Margot read the contents of the torture kit to herself. Mace, nails, piano wire, spikes, rope, drill, circular saw, staple gun. Then a large brown truck pulled up and two government priests got out. They unlocked the back of the truck and pulled out a thin, dark-skinned man dressed in a white toga. He looked frightened and confused. His hands and feet were shackled, and as the two priests pushed him up the walk, he pitched and swayed. Freddy stopped talking. She just stared greedily with her mouth hanging open. Which one of you is Margot Lynn, widow of Albert Lynn? One of the priests asked. I am, Margot replied. In accordance with the laws of Christian America, the priest said, we bring you as recompense for your recent loss this infidel. He is called Ali Baba, and he is yours to do with whatever you please. The priest then took Ali Baba into the house. The other priest had Margot sign the official forms and gave her a number to call when she was ready to have the remains hauled away. That is, if there are any, he smiled. We understand total incineration is quite popular these days. The first priest returned from the house and gave Margot the key to the shackles. I locked him to the radiator in the basement, he said. Then the two priests drove off. As soon as they were gone, Freddy grabbed Margot by the wrist. Oh, Margot, you have to let me help. It wouldn't be right of you to do it all alone. You should do it with someone who cares about you, someone who cared about Albert, someone like me. Margot yanked her arm free and stepped into the house. Thank you very much for the present, Freddy, but I don't want your help. This is a personal thing. I'm sure you understand. Then she slammed the door. It took Margot 3 hours to get up the courage to go down into the basement. She brought with her the new Walmart torture kit and her Bible. Ali Baba was praying. At least that's what it looked like to Margot. He was slumped next to the radiator with his legs crossed and his hands raised over his head, which he had buried in the crook of his arm. She pulled up a chair and waited for him to finish. But after a while, she realized that he was not praying, but was rather asleep. Since his hand shackles were locked to the top of the radiator, Ali Baba was locked into this strange position. When he awoke, he opened his eyes and stared at her without saying anything. I want you to tell me why you did it, Margot said, articulating every word. I want you to tell me why you had to blow up the airplane my husband was on. Ali Baba looked away. I'm sorry, he stuttered. I remember nothing. What do you mean? You don't remember anything at all? Margot asked. No, only the hospital lights, Ali Baba said sadly. But clones are supposed to retain their memories, Margot said. If that is so, then perhaps a mistake was made. The government doesn't make mistakes, Margot snapped back. They took your DNA from the wreckage of the airplane and cloned you. You are a terrorist. You were hiding in the baggage compartment. You killed my husband. I remember nothing, Ali Baba repeated. Margot realized she'd never heard an Arab voice in person before, only on the telly and the government videos. What about your Allah? Margot asked. Do you remember anything about your religion, Islam? I tell you, I remember nothing, Ali Baba said once again. He looked like he was ready to cry now. But if you like, he stuttered. I will tell you the dream I was having as I awoke. Tell me, Margot said. There was a man who had committed 99 murders, Ali Baba said, shifting his weight around. The man went to see the scholar of Allah. He asked, "Is there any chance of my being forgiven?" The scholar said, "No, you have committed too many crimes." So the man killed the scholar too. But his heart was restless, so he went to another scholar and asked the same question. This time he was told yes, but only on the condition that he leave the wicked town and go live in the next town in the company of good people. So the man set out to the town he was told to go to, but on the way he died. A man passing by saw two angels arguing over his dead body. The angel from hell said, "His body belongs to me, as he had not done any good in his life." But the angel from heaven said, "No, his body belongs to me, as he had repented and was on his way to be with good people." The man who was the passerby said, "Let us measure the distance of his body from the town he left and the town he was going to." This was done, and he was found nearer to the town he was going to. So the man's soul departed with the angel of heaven. "What does it mean?" Margot asked. Alibaba lowered his gaze again. "I'm not certain." Margot opened up her Bible. "In the book of Matthew," she said, "someone asked Jesus how many times we should forgive our fellow man, and he says 70 times, 7 times. Now, some people believe that this means there's a limit to how much wrongdoing we have to take." Margot stared hard at Alibaba, letting him know that it was not okay for him to avert his eyes again. "Albert, my husband believed that." Tears started to roll down her face. "But even though every child knows that 70 times 7 is 490, she continued, "I think what Jesus really meant by 70 times 7 was infinity." She buried her head in her hands and began to sob. Alibaba waited until she drew quiet. "In my dream," he said, "I was the man who desired forgiveness." Margot wiped her eyes, opened up the Walmart Deluxe torture box, and took out the handheld circular saw. "So," she asked, flicking on the switch, "from right here then, in this basement, what do you think is closer, heaven or hell?" The saw drowned out Alibaba's reply, but Margot heard it just the same. Days later, Margot returned to work. Her co-workers presented her with a gold-framed picture of Albert for her desk. Norma told her everyone in the office had chipped in, except for Freddie. Freddie was telling everybody that she'd already spent enough money on Margot, and according to Paul, she was even contemplating turning Margot in for the sin of ungratefulness. Margot's friends convinced her that it would be best to try and placate Freddie. So Margot walked over to Freddie's desk and thanked her once again for the deluxe Walmart torture kit. "You could have at least brought me a body part or two," Freddie snorted. "Well, Freddie," Margot lied, "you're in luck. I haven't burned all the remains yet." Freddie clasped her hands together. "Oh, Margot, can I have the infidel's testicles?" "Sure," Margot nodded her head. "I'll bring them for you tomorrow." "Excellent," Freddie shouted, slapping Margot on the back. "So tell us how it went. Did you like the torture kit? What did you enjoy the most? The clippers? The razor wire?" It went very quickly, Margot said. I just wanted it to be over. Freddy groaned. Well, I hope you at least made it painful. The president would sure be upset if he found out some infidel died an easy death here in Christian America. Freddy saluted the gigantic picture of President Samuel P. Huntington that hung on the office wall and crossed herself. Did I ever tell you about the time I got to send two infidels back to their stinking Allah? She asked. Paul and Norma suddenly remembered they had something to get from the other room. Everyone in the office, including Margot's, heard this story at least 100 times. 5 years ago, Freddy went on anyway, a cousin of my niece's friend got shot by terrorists, and her family got 2 towel heads as recompense, and I got invited to the torture ceremony. Freddy's eyes glassed over, and beads of sweat emerged from the folds in her neck. First, we tortured them with saws and clippers. We sliced open their muscles and popped out their kneecaps, and then we shoved forks into their abdomens, and then we wrapped their heads with towels soaked in kerosene, and as they burned, we had the little ones dance around them, shouting, "Jesus is better than Allah! Jesus is better than Allah!" It was a perfect execution of God's will, Freddy said, choking up. Then she turned and saluted the picture of President Huntington again. At lunch, Margot confided to Norma and Paul that she'd already had the remains of Ali Baba taken away. "So what are you going to bring Freddy tomorrow?" Paul asked. "I don't know," Margot replied. "I was hoping you two would have some suggestions." "If only there were still peaches," Norma said sadly. "Don't you think peach pits would have worked?" "Yes," Margot said, "peach pits would have been brilliant." "I have some canned peaches in my cellar," Paul said quietly. "You do?" Margot and Norma shouted at the same time. "Yes, and I believe they're whole peaches," Paul added. "You know, they used to take the pits out when they canned fruit, but the stuff I have is from when they were packing it in as fast as they could, when they realized that the genetically modified food plague was going to wipe out all the fruit crops for good. I even have canned bananas." Margot squeezed Paul's hand. "You are so wonderful and kind, Paul. But it's my fault for lying to Freddy in the first place. I can't have you waste your peaches for that." "It's okay," Paul winked. "I insist. I'll bring you your 2 testicles tomorrow." When Margot returned home from work that evening, she grilled 2 Velveeta sandwiches and took them down to the basement. Ali Baba was so engrossed in his reading, he didn't even notice her come down the stairs. When she set these sandwiches on the table next to his chair, he jumped up into the air and screeched like a trapped mouse. Margot put her hand to her mouth and giggled. Ali Baba looked ridiculous in Albert's clothes. He looked like a child wearing his older brother's hand-me-downs. But still, there was something very comforting about seeing Ali Baba dressed in Albert's sheepskin vest and green hunting cap. "What are you reading?" she asked. "I am reading your Bible some more," Ali Baba replied. "I was reading the book of Joshua." "Oh," Margot said, crinkling her nose. "What do you think of it?" "Your God is very, very wicked," Ali Baba shouted. He opened up the Bible and started to read. "They utterly destroyed all that was in the city, both man and woman, young and old, and ox and sheep and ass, with the edge of the sword. And then they burnt the city with fire and all that was therein. Only the silver, the gold, the vessels of brass and iron, these they put in the treasury of the house of the Lord. Joshua drew not his hand back until he had utterly destroyed all the inhabitants. He left none remaining, but utterly destroyed all that breathed, as the Lord God of Israel commanded." Ali Baba closed the book and scratched his neck. "I thought you told me that your God is love." "He is," Margot replied. "Well, some of the time. You need to read the New Testament. God is much nicer in the New Testament." "Why is he not always the same?" Ali Baba asked. Margot didn't say anything. Ali Baba picked up one of the sandwiches and sniffed it. "It's okay, you can eat it," Margot laughed. "It's Velveeta." Ali Baba took a small, careful bite. "Thank you. You are so very nice." Margot sat down on the sofa across from Alibaba's chair. "I put in the request for permission to go to Vermont today," she said. "I made up a story that Vermont is where Albert and I first met when we were young and how it would help me in the grieving process if I could just go for a visit. My request is sure to be approved, maybe even by the end of next week, and by then the insurance check will have arrived, so I'll have money to rent us the car." "Explain to me again this plan," Alibaba asked, licking the crumbs from his fingers. "Well, first," Margot replied, "we're going to rent a car. You're going to have to ride in the trunk, of course, but we're going to drive to Vermont. That is where the Alaskan Secret Underground Railroad is. We're going to send you to the Republic of Alaska." Alibaba picked up the other sandwich. "Alaska is up north," Margot continued, "above Canada. It's where all the liberal heathens fled to when the war started. They form their own country. They say it's the capital of world cosmopolitanism now." "And what is that?" Alibaba asked. "Cosmopolitanism is where all kinds of people live together. People with different skin colors, people with different religions, people with different sexual preferences, all kinds of people." "And tell me again why you are doing this for me." "Because," Margot replied, "if we want God to be love all the time, then we have to set him an example." Later that night, Margot studied the map that hung on the wall in the den. She measured the distance between the town of Medford, Massachusetts, and Alaska. Then she measured the distance between Medford and the United States of Arabia. Alaska was closer. She changed into her nightgown and stared at a reflection in the mirror. There were dark circles under her eyes, and the lower part of her face was trembling. She did not look like a woman swimming in God's good graces. She watched the tears roll down her cheeks. It made no sense. Why was she still suffering so? She was doing a good deed. She was practicing forgiveness, the kind of forgiveness Jesus taught in the Gospels. But yet, each step she took towards this forgiveness illuminated not the goodness or grace of God, but rather a vast and empty void. A void in which she floated, silent and alone. And it was not the void of Albert's absence. Albert's death had merely opened up her eyes. It was a void that had always been and would always be. Margot turned out the lights and crawled into bed. She could hear Alibaba moving around in the basement. It was too dangerous for him to come upstairs. Albert had worked in the ministry. There was a good chance there were secret cameras in his office and in the living room. Of course, there could be cameras in the basement as well, but if that was the case, then the government priest would have already come for Alibaba and herself. There was already so much to worry about. Margot counted in her head the number of variables and uncertainties that lay stretched out before her like an obstacle course. Then, she got out of bed and, under the cover of darkness, felt her way out of the bedroom and down the hallway. When she reached the basement stairs, she called out to Alibaba in a soft voice so that she would not frighten him again. And then she started down the stairs. The next day, Margot gave Freddy the peach pits Paul brought for her. Freddy went nuts over them. "These really make my collection something, don't you think?" Margot nodded her head politely. Freddy's desk was a veritable museum of human grizzle. Severed ears from when her grandfather fought in the Fourth Iraqi War, a foot that had been ripped off a suicide bomber's leg and bronzed, scalps which hung from pushpins on her corkboard, and now two peach pits she believed to be testicles. At lunch, Margot was unable to keep up with the conversation. She found herself lingering on every word, savoring every gesture, committing every little thing to memory. Because soon, that's all Paul and Norma would be. Memories. For you see, Margot has decided to go to Alaska with Alibaba. is never an easy decision to decide to go to war. The inevitable loss of life and property cannot be taken lightly. But when one is confronted by an adversary so absolutely abominable, so decidedly despicable as the one who has amassed his forces against us, then there can be no other choice but war. For our adversary threatens not only our freedom and our way of life, he threatens our very existence. Our adversary wants nothing more than our total and complete annihilation. So tonight, my dear listeners, I am declaring war on our adversary, and I come before you in the hope that you will join me in this most righteous of crusades. For if it is to enjoy even the possibility of success, I am going to need your help. You see, our adversary is very, very powerful. He is, in fact, the supreme being of the universe. Yes, my dear listeners, our adversary is God. Now, I know that some of you out there will find this disturbing. I can already see you shaking your heads, reaching for the radio dial, but please hear me out. You are not alone in your faith in God. Half this planet believes that God wants for us only eternal happiness and everlasting life, but it is time for you to wipe the mud from your eyes. Tonight, you must emerge from the darkness. God does not care about us. Our cries for help, they only excite him. Our tears, they make him wet. Our pleas, God gets a hard-on from our pleas. Our pain tickles his erogenous zones. And our sufferings make him writhe in ecstasy. In your heart, you know I speak the truth. For if God was love, then there would be no death camps or gas chambers, no massacres or starvation, no rape or torture. If God was love, then he would have long ago put a stop to the carnage, the slaughter, the wholesale killing. Face it, God is one sick bastard. Yes, my dear listeners, our adversary, our enemy is God. And if we hope to defeat him, we must arm ourselves not only with courage and resolution, but with firepower as well. For this is not a metaphorical crusade. We are not going to kill God with words, nor will we create a political system that simply leaves him out. No, this is the real thing. This is a crusade to take God's ass out for once and for all. We're going to storm the gates of heaven, and we're going to put the seraphim and the little cherubs to the sword. We're going to mow down the heavenly hosts with automatic weapon fire. We're going to pull down the pearly gates and tear up the golden streets with tanks. We will not rest until God's body swings from our banner. We will not rest until God's head sits atop one of our bayonets. Yes, my dear listeners, this is war. The war to end all wars. The most holiest of holy wars. And tonight, you must decide which site you want to fight for. Because this is a crusade to rid not only the heavens of God, but the earth as well. I mean, let's face it, all of God's chosen people are assholes. And we crusaders cannot stop until we've rooted out every single last one of them from our midst. So bear in mind, there are only two choices. You can join this crusade, or you can be crusaded. Now, I'm of course aware that while some of you out there in listener land may find this idea of a holy war intriguing, even compelling, there are still some questions you'd like to have answered. So I would like now to open up the floor for your questions or comments. If you have a question or a comment, please stand up and speak your piece.
Hello?
Yes, you in the front row.
What do you mean when you say God?
Yes, God does have several names. Jehovah, Allah, Buddha, the Great Spirit, L. Ron Hubbard. But you must never forget that these are just aliases he's assumed over the ages. There is only one supreme being. And in the interest of keeping things simple, I vote we stick to referring to him as God. It's short, simple, and one syllable. Easy to remember.
Hello?
Yes, you on the left.
You know, I really take issue with your earlier comment that all God's children are assholes. What are you, some sort of anti-Semite?
No. I'm not an anti-Semite, nor am I an anti-Arab or an anti-white Anglo-Saxon. I'm simply anti-God. Next.
Hello?
Yes.
Have you ever thought that maybe we humans aren't capable of understanding God's way? I agree with you that all the suffering and the murdering in the world is bad, but maybe we just don't understand that this is all part of God's greater plan for us.
What if I came over to your house and beat you black and blue with a hammer, and then after tying you naked to your stove, repeatedly ram my penis into your rectum all the while telling you that I loved you, and then when I was finished, what if I untied you and told you that you were just too stupid to understand my way, and that I'd be back the following night and we'd do it all again? What would you do? Would you vacuum the house and have dinner ready for when I showed up again? Or would you wait quietly in the dark for my return with a loaded semi-automatic rifle?
Hello?
Yes.
Yes, I agree with you that it's so distressing that there's so much pain and suffering in the world, but I don't think you can blame God for that. I mean, God gave us free will. If you wanted to, you could force us to be good, but we would be robots. Free will is a good thing.
But we're not the only ones with free will. God has free will as well. And when God hears our screams of pain and our cries for mercy, he has the ability to help us. And sometimes he chooses not to. But who would choose not to help a mother who's being forced to watch her child be gutted in front of her? Who would choose not to help a little girl being gang raped by 30 soldiers? But I do agree with you. Free will is a good thing. I'm glad I have it, for I have freely chosen to launch this crusade. Thanks to free will, we can choose to go up to heaven and kick God's sorry ass.
Hello?
One more question.
Yeah, I just have one question. This all sounds really good to me. I'm actually pretty excited about it. I'm just wondering, is there going to be any, like, you know, war booty?
Yes, the spoils of this holy war will be infinite possibility, supreme knowledge, and everlasting happiness. I'd like now to move on to our plan of attack. It's my opinion that we should start off with a ground assault, maybe 2 million troops backed up with a couple hundred thousand Apache helicopters, and then...
Hello?
Okay, one more question, but this has to be the last one. We have lots and lots of work to do tonight.
I was just wondering if you've tried diplomacy at all. I mean, maybe there's a way that you could, you know, make peace with God and avoid war. Have you ever even thought about that?
No. Before Margo and Ali Baba were due to set out for Alaska, Norma caught Freddy stealing a can of Coca-Cola from the refrigerator in the kitchen. She walked over to Margo's desk and whispered into her ear, 490, game over for Freddy. Margo got up from her desk and hurried into the kitchen. She pulled out the piece of paper they kept hidden behind the water cooler. She tallied up the marks. Sure enough, there were 490. Margo walked back to her desk and looked over at Norma. Norma was beaming. She'd been looking forward to this day for quite some time, for Margo had promised her that once Freddy passed the 490 mark, she would back Norma up when she reported Freddy for the sin of stealing. At lunch, after Paul cleared away his tray, Margo begged Norma to reconsider. No, Margo, Norma said firmly. Freddy has already had more chances than she deserves, and you know as well as I do that she would never give anyone, not even her mother, a second chance. We've given her 489, at least. Margo lowered her eyes. Yes, Norma hissed. Don't think I haven't noticed the slack you've been cutting her lately. It was true. Margo had stopped recording when Freddy broke the 400 mark. But Norma, Margo begged, she has children. I know that, Norma replied. Think of the horrors they must be subjected to. Face it, Margot, Freddy is a terror. She's mean and she's cruel. She terrorizes everyone in this office. We live in constant fear because of her, and now it's time for her to go. When we are finished with lunch, I'm going to report her for stealing, and you are going to back me up like you promised me you would, and that will be the end of it. Before the day is over, they will come and take her away, and we will never have to worry about what she might do to us ever again. But Norma, Margot was pleading now, if we turn Freddy in, then they will torture her. It's not our fault that Freddy is a liar, a slanderer, and a thief. Norma was angry now. But think about how much she will suffer, Margot whispered. I do think about her suffering, Norma said. And to tell you the truth, Margot, I like to think of her suffering. I'm sorry, but she is evil. If anyone deserves to suffer, it's Freddy. Margot reached across the table and took Norma by the hand. Think of what you're saying, Norma. Norma pulled her hand away and covered her eyes with it. Then tell me what to do, Margot, because I have to do something. I want you to forgive Freddy, Margot replied. Why? Because it's what God wants us to do. So you want to keep turning a blind eye? Norma shook her head in disbelief. No, Margot said, not a blind eye, but a forgiving eye. Norma was silent for a moment. And then she nodded her head. Okay, Margot. Okay. Margot could see that her friend was being sincere, and it made her want to tell her everything. How in 2 days she would be leaving for Vermont with Alibaba in search of the Alaskan Underground Railway. But she bit her lip, for even though she knew Norma was her friend, she was still uncertain of what she would make of her newfound happiness with the infidel. So instead, she decided to write Norma a note. After lunch, she turned the tally sheet over, the one with the 490 marks on it, and wrote, Dear Norma, when you read this, I will be on my way to Alaska. I'm sorry I didn't say goodbye, and I hope that you will forgive me and think of me as often as I will think of you. I'm not alone. I have a new friend. His name is Alibaba. Remember the clone I got as recompense for Albert? Well, instead of torturing and killing him, I chose to forgive him. Obviously, he couldn't stay in Christian America, and at first I simply planned to help him get to Alaska, and that would be the end of it. But, well, I've decided to go with him. He's very kind and handsome, too. I think I'm even beginning to fall in love with him. I know this will come as a shock to you, but please don't think I've lost my mind. Far from it. I still believe in Jesus, and I plan on remaining a Christian, even though I will be living in a country that is known for its cosmopolitanism. Please don't think me selfish, but it's my hope that one day you will come and live with us. I wish there was a way for me to contact you when I get there and tell you about what things are like, but of course that will be impossible. I think it will be best if you burn this note, even though it means destroying the record of Freddy's 490 stolen Coca-Colas. Perhaps you can start another one, and every time you make a mark, you can think of me. Oh, Norma, I'm so happy you were able to forgive Freddy, because there really is no other way. If we want God to forgive us our sins, then we must forgive the sins of others. I love you, Norma, and I look forward to the day we will be together again. When she got home, she read Alibaba the note, leaving out only the part about her starting to fall in love and he being handsome. She was too shy and modest to read something like that out loud. Alibaba listened with amazement. What will she think about me? About us? Oh, it will totally blow her mind. Margot imagined Norma reading the letter and laughed. She'll probably fall out of her chair. And why do you think she will come to Alaska to be with us? Because, Margot answered, deep down inside, I've always suspected that Norma is secretly a cosmopolitan, and everybody knows that Alaska is the cosmopolitan capital of the world. That night, Margot dreamed about her future life with Alibaba. They lived in Alaska in a beautiful house with 6 children. Some of the children were white and some were brown, but they were all beautiful. and there were peach trees in the backyard. Everyone in Alaska was kind and friendly, and there were always neighborhood parties and celebrations where the children would play games while the adults roasted bananas and drank out of triangle-shaped glasses. It was a perfect existence, except for one thing. For some reason, in the basement, there was a door next to the radiator. And as the years progressed, as the children grew older and began happy families of their own, this door grew in size and stature. Until one day, Margot decided to open it, just an inch to see what was behind it. But as soon as she turned the handle, whatever was on the other side threw all its weight on it, and the door swung open, knocking Margot to the ground. It was Freddy. She wore her silver jumpsuit and she held a hammer in one hand and a hacksaw in the other. Margot scrambled to her feet and started up the stairs. Freddy threw back her head and let out a murderous howl. And then she started after her. Margot woke up in Ali Baba's arms, but her fear was so terrible, so fierce, he was unable to quell her shivers. And so they passed away the night, trembling in the darkness, together. In the book of Matthew, Peter approaches Jesus and asks him, "Lord, if my brother sins against me, how often must I forgive him?" Jesus answers, "I say unto you, 70 times 7 times." And then he tells all his disciples the parable of the unforgiving servant. The kingdom of heaven may be likened to a king who decided to settle accounts with his servants. When he began the accounting, a debtor was brought before him who owed him a huge amount. Since he had no way of paying it back, his master ordered him to be sold, along with his wife, his children, and all of his property, in payment of the debt. At that, the servant fell down and begged, "Be patient with me, master. I promise you I will pay the debt back in full." Moved to compassion, the master of that servant let him go and forgave him the loan. As soon as this servant had left, he found one of his fellow servants who owed him a much smaller amount. He seized him and started to choke him, demanding, "Pay back what you owe." Falling to his knees, his fellow servant begged him, "Be patient with me, and I will pay you back." But he refused. Instead, he had him put into prison until he paid back the debt in full. Now, when his fellow servant saw what had happened, they were deeply disturbed, and they went to their master and reported the whole affair. His master summoned him and said to him, "You wicked servant, I forgave you your entire debt because you begged me to. Shouldn't you not have had pity on your fellow servant as I had pity on you?" Then in anger, the master handed him over to the torturers until he should pay back the debt in its entirety. This idea of a forgiveness that is conditional is the guiding force of Margot's religious worldview. She believes, as Jesus says, also in the book of Matthew, "If you forgive others their transgressions, your heavenly Father will forgive you. But if you do not forgive others, neither will your Father forgive your transgressions." This is why she's so opposed to turning Freddy in for the sin of stealing. For she believes with all her heart that God will not forgive her sins if she cannot find it in her to forgive Freddy's sins. Norma, however, wanted to turn Freddy in the very first time she caught her stealing a Coca-Cola, because the guiding force of Norma's religious worldview is an absolute hatred of hypocrisy. Freddy lies, cheats, slanders, and steals, but yet she also prides herself on pointing out even the slightest faults in others. And since the laws of Christian America are so barbaric, the consequences of Freddy's tattletelling are more often than not devastating. So why then does Norma agree to Margot's requests? If Norma finds Freddy's hypocrisy so loathsome, How could she then agree to forgive Freddy not only 490 times, but an infinite number of times? There are two reasons. The first is that in theory, Norma aspires to be more like Margot. Margot responds to cruelty only with kindness, and she counters hatred always with compassion. In Norma's eyes, Margot is the antithesis of hypocrisy. The second reason is sheer practicality. Norma knows that it will only be a matter of time before Freddy steals 490 cans of Coca-Cola. And then when she realizes that Margot actually means to forgive Freddy indefinitely, she still believes that eventually someone will catch Freddy and turn her in. For like Margot, Norma believes in a forgiveness that is conditional. And like Margot, Norma believes in the parable of the ungrateful servant. Norma believes that Freddy will eventually be punished for her hypocrisy, just as the ungrateful servant is punished. The guiding force of Freddy's religious worldview is unconditional forgiveness. Freddy believes that, as Luke says in the book of Acts, everyone who believes in Jesus will receive forgiveness of sins through his name. This is why Freddy never bothers with the rite of confession. Of course, she knows that sinning is wrong, and she knows that God would be happier if she cut out all her lying, stealing, snooping, and snitching. But since she believes that God's forgiveness is unconditional, she doesn't pay that much attention to her own sins. In fact, Freddy possesses not a single shred of self-awareness. In this sense, Freddy is like the unforgiving servant. Like him, she is unaware of even the golden rule, that one should treat others the same way one would like to be treated by others. But the servant's wickedness pales in comparison to Freddy's. For while he is unable to show his fellow servant the same mercy his master had shown unto him, Freddy refuses mercy to the very person who was merciful unto her. On the day before Margot was set to leave for Alaska with Alibaba, she placed the letter she'd written in the bottom drawer of Norma's desk, where she knew Norma would find it the following Monday. Freddy watched her doing this, and being nosy, fished it out when Norma, Margot, and Paul were having their last lunch together in the cafeteria. She took it into the bathroom and locked herself in one of the stalls. Then she opened it and read it. When she finished, she tore everything up and flushed the scraps of paper down the toilet. Then, she went and reported Margot to the Father Superior. The figure of 70x7 does not make an appearance in the Quran, but Muhammad does lay out the requirements necessary for one to receive forgiveness from God. If the offense is one committed against God himself, there are three. 1. Recognizing the offense itself and its admission before God. 2. Making a commitment not to repeat the offense. And 3. Asking for forgiveness from God. If the offense is one committed against another human being or against society, there are 4 requirements. 1. Recognizing the offense before those whom the offense was committed and before God. 2. Committing oneself not to repeat the offense. 3. Doing whatever needs to be done to rectify the offense. And 4. Asking God for forgiveness. While the Bible presents us with conflicting passages as to what the exact nature of God's forgiveness is, the Quran makes it clear that there is no such thing as unconditional forgiveness. In order to receive God's forgiveness, he requires that we not only forgive the offenses of others as we would have him forgive us our own offenses, but he also requires that we commit ourselves to rectifying our offenses. This is the guiding force of Alibaba's religious worldview. He believes that since he is responsible for the death of Margot's husband, then it is his duty to be her new husband. Alibaba takes the concept of rectification very seriously, perhaps even too seriously, for the Quran states that we are only required to rectify our offenses within reason, and it is not reasonable to take up the marital responsibilities of the person you have murdered. But it would be unfair of us to judge Alibaba, because the cloning process wiped out his mind. And that is the major flaw of Alibaba's religious worldview: missing facts. There was no bomb. The plane Albert was on blew up because the fuel tanks were loaded improperly. Alibaba was hiding in the baggage compartment, not as a terrorist, but rather as a stowaway. He was on his way to South America. He had deserted from the United Arabian Army, and he was on his way to Brazil in search of a new life. Alibaba is therefore like the man who was told by the scholar of Allah that forgiveness is contingent on a change in direction. As Muhammad says time and time again, God demands that we always be moving in the direction of the truth, the light, and the way. The major flaw of Margot's religious worldview is that she equates her loneliness and unhappiness with sin. When she was a child, both of her parents were killed by heretics. She grew up in an orphanage, and whenever she would cry, the nuns would beat her and accuse her of being ungrateful. Then, when Albert came and took her away, it was only under the condition that she cook, clean, and bear him children. She performed her household duties to his satisfaction, but miscarried their only child, Annie. When she cried over this loss, Albert accused her of sloth and laziness. Margot's determination to forgive even the sins of someone like Freddy stem from a desperate desire for divine forgiveness. Perhaps if Margot had made it to Alaska, then she could have enrolled in therapy and discovered that what she really needed was to forgive herself. How many sessions this would have taken, though, we have no way of knowing. The major flaw in Norma's religious worldview is her belief that evil is always punished. She foregoes turning Freddy in because she believes that inevitably Freddy will be caught and brought to justice. But Freddy never has to account for herself. In fact, after the Margot incident, she gets promoted. She gets her own office. Freddy is therefore, in the end, not like the ungrateful servant at all. For while he ends up thrown to the torturers, she remains a torturer until the end of her life. On her deathbed, she has her children bring her baby infidels, whom she places underneath her body, until they're crushed by her massive bulk. Freddy lives to the age of 77, and when she does die, it is with a smile on her face, for Freddy never once stopped believing unconditionally in God. 35 years before Freddy passes on, Norma decides to emigrate to the Republic of Alaska. Unfortunately, though, she doesn't make it. She's captured at the Massachusetts border and burned at the stake, along with a 14-year-old boy whose crime is excessive masturbation. Before Margot was due to set out for Alaska with Alibaba, Mary Kate caught Freddy snooping around in Norma's desk. She watched Freddy take a letter from the bottom drawer and slip it into her pocket. Mary Kate, who was no friend of Freddy's, decided to go and find Norma. She found her in the cafeteria, eating lunch with Margot and Paul. When she told Norma what she'd just witnessed, Margot turned white, excused herself, and left the room. Margot took the back stairs to the first floor. She climbed out a window which led to the back alley. She ran up Tremont Street until she found a taxi. She got in and gave him her address. As they flew across town, she formulated a plan. She would wrap Ali Baba's head and hands up with bandages. They would then take a taxi to the car dealership. If they could get to the car dealership before Freddy did anything, then they might still make it. If anyone asked any questions, she would simply say she was driving her sick husband to his doctor's appointment. When they came to the house, she asked the taxi driver to wait outside until she came back out with her husband. Then she ran into the house. Ali Baba was sitting in the basement reading the Book of Job. Margot frantically started shoving things into a duffel bag, underwear, toothpaste. "I do not understand why your God must play so many games," Ali Baba asked, putting down the book. Margot handed Ali Baba his toga and a pair of scissors. She told him to start cutting it into long strips. Then she told him what had just happened. Ali Baba didn't say anything. He simply picked up the scissors and began to cut the toga into long strips. Margot finished packing the bag. Then, as she started wrapping Ali Baba's face with the bandages, she heard the unmistakable sound of the sirens. At first, it was just a faint murmur, a faraway moan. But when the four church police cars pulled up on the front lawn, the noise was deafening. Margot realized that the sirens made the same sound Freddy made whenever she yelled at someone in the office. It was just louder, amplified. Freddy amplified to the power of 70 times 7. Margot grabbed Ali Baba by the hand and pushed him into the closet. She went in after him and pulled the door shut behind them. They could hear the church cops walking around upstairs now. Margot unwrapped the bandages from the lower part of Ali Baba's face and gave him a kiss on the mouth. He put his arms around her and they stood like this in the still of their embrace and waited.
Listening to Benjamin Walker's Your Radio Nightlight. Tonight's broadcast is entitled Holy War. Visit Your Radio Nightlight on the web at yourlight.org and tune in next week for another broadcast right here on WZBC 90.3 FM in Newton.